Opponents are calling it a gag rule. Advocates call it the Truth in Advertising Law. Back in the spring, Connecticut lawmakers passed a bill that would target deceptive messaging from crisis pregnancy centers. These centers are run by faith-based groups that try to steer women away from abortions, but the new law in Connecticut prohibits them from using deceptive practices, such as posing as doctors or distributing misleading information about abortions. Now one of these centers, they say, is fighting for their First Amendment rights. This is And Another Thing. I'm Dara Kennedy.
I'm Maya Schwader. According to Narrell Pro-Choice Connecticut, there are 25 pregnancy centers in the state and one mobile van. One of these is CareNet, the pregnancy center at the center of the lawsuit. The Alliance Defending Freedom filed the suit on their behalf. They say that not only is this infringing their free speech rights, but that there is already a law in Connecticut that would prevent these deceptive practices. Joining us now is Denise Harley. She is senior counsel with the Alliance Defending Freedom, or ADF. Welcome to the show. So you have a lawsuit against the Attorney General of Connecticut that says that CareNet, and I'm paraphrasing here, is banned from communicating freely. What is it about the CareNet message that's being restricted?
We do. So the state of Connecticut passed a law that bans certain, as it's labeled, deceptive speech or practices only by pro-life pregnancy centers if they don't provide or refer for abortion. Unfortunately, the law is written so vaguely that it gives unbridled discretion to the government officials like the Attorney General to enforce it against the sorts of truthful, commonplace messages that CareNet has used. So just as an example, the Attorney General has gone on the record on news shows saying that a violation of this law would be if CareNet said something like pregnant, need help, in an advertisement. And that's the sort of thing that CareNet says all the time to try to reach the pregnant women who are in need to offer the free support services. And so because of that danger of a $500 fine for almost anything that CareNet says that the Attorney General doesn't like, we filed a lawsuit under the First Amendment.
So there is also this act on the books called the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act. The ADF has argued that this act already has things like deceptive messaging covered. The Attorney General has said, no, it isn't. That's why this new law was necessary. Is there not an argument to be made that if CareNet was following these guidelines, the new law wouldn't have been put in place in the first place?
Well, that's definitely not the argument, because after year after year after year, the legislature has tried to pass this bill, and they've finally been successful, and they've not introduced one piece of evidence or one testimony from a single woman who's been deceived by any pregnancy center in the state. So definitely there's no evidence of a problem or that the law is necessary. But to the contrary, CUTPA actually is an even-handed across-the-board law that regulates deceptive advertising. CareNet has no concerns with that. What we do have a concern with is that our particular pro-life viewpoint is being singled out, so that pro-life nonprofits are subject to additional restrictions that give the Attorney General even more leeway. And unless the Attorney General has changed his position, he has actually said for the past 2 or 3 years that he doesn't know whether or not CUTPA covers nonprofits.
So as a result of the law that you're challenging, has CareNet altered any of its usual practices or language?
I think CareNet has been really concerned about its advertising. I don't know that they have changed any of the messages yet, but it's a hesitancy. So every time they post something, it's a possibility that there's going to be a demand letter from the Attorney General who can immediately drag CareNet into court.
Its website, it contains many claims that critics are considering false advertising. Has it altered any of these messages that have been considered false advertising?
CareNet feels that everything it has said is truthful, even those things that the Attorney General claims are deceptive. And so CareNet is going to continue to reach out to women and offer their free services in the same way that they have been doing.
So part of the background of this, looming in the background of all of this, is, of course, this new law that was passed in Texas, Senate Bill 8, that has put severe restrictions on abortions in Texas. Is that part of what has spurred CareNet and the ADF to take this up?
I don't think that's in the background, and I don't think that's related at all. In fact, that came about after the fact of when this law was passed, and we knew as soon as this law was passed, we were planning to challenge it. In fact, way back in February, I testified in the legislature against this bill. This bill doesn't have anything to do with abortion. It's about free speech and the fact that the government can't target certain speakers who have certain viewpoints for different kinds of speech restrictions. With tolerance and good faith in America require people of all different viewpoints to be able to share their opinions and beliefs and offer their services without being targeted for government punishment. So, no, I don't see any link at all.
Denise Harley is a senior counsel with the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
With 1,100 locations around North America, CareNet pregnancy centers reach thousands of consumers. The lawsuit filed against Connecticut on behalf of CareNet 2 weeks ago claims, as we just heard, Connecticut's new law bans CareNet from communicating freely with the individuals it serves and those that it wishes to serve. It's also seeking a court order to block a declaration that it violates free speech and freedom of religion guaranteed under the Constitution.
Wrapped up in the ADF's challenge is the new Connecticut law that we mentioned previously is CUTPA, which is designed to prevent misleading marketing. Under this new law, which was passed in the spring, Connecticut Attorney General Tong's office will investigate complaints and impose a fine to centers found in violation.
We now welcome in Connecticut Attorney General William Tong, who is being sued by the Alliance Defending Freedom. AG Tong, we know that you are a defendant in this federal case where the ADF cites a violation of the First Amendment. We know that you can't speak directly to the details of the lawsuit, but how is the First Amendment being defined in this instance?
So thanks for having me on to talk about this very important issue. And basically, the point of this statute is to protect people, particularly young women who might be pregnant and might be considering what her options are, to make sure that they're not lied to, that they're not deceived, as they make a very important decision about what to do with respect to their health care, their health, and their pregnancy.
What is that Connecticut law?
So frankly, it's a very simple law and a very simple statute that provides that we here in Connecticut will protect people from getting lied to. That's known as the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act, or CUTPA. Every state has a law like CUTPA. Connecticut has a particularly strong law. It's called CUTPA, and it gives me broad authority to protect people, again, from being deceived or lied to, or to protect them from being victims of fraud, for example. All of us, as American citizens and citizens of the state of Connecticut, have a First Amendment right to free speech, of course. And that protects what is generally known as political speech at the core of the First Amendment, right? If we want to go out to the town green and talk about public policy matters that affect us in our community, we have every right to do that. What you don't have the right to do is to say whatever you want under any circumstances whatsoever without regard to what happens to other people, right? We all know from high school civics, you can't shout fire in a crowded theater and cause a panic and put people at risk. That's not protected by the First Amendment. What's also not protected is lying to people, deceiving them when you're marketing something.
So the question is, Attorney General Tong, what is the actual lie?
Well, the lie, of course, that people are trying to protect themselves against, and that I am charged with protecting people against, is when somebody's marketing some service, in this case, when they're marketing around so-called crisis pregnancy centers, they have to tell the truth. You can't shade the truth, where maybe you have some argument, right, that you haven't actually told a lie. But it's so shrouded in fraud and deceit that, you know, a regular person, a reasonable person, wouldn't be able to tell the difference, and they could find themselves deceived.
Unpopular speech is still protected speech, and it all falls under the First Amendment. How is it that this has continued to pass on the Supreme Court for many years?
Well, unpopular speech is a particularly speech around public policy issues. Political speech is at the core of the First Amendment. And I'd be the first to say that it's my job and the job of every other attorney general and every court in this country and lawyers broadly to honor free speech and to honor the First Amendment and to do everything we can to protect it. I don't believe that this statute impairs the First Amendment. I believe that courts and the U.S. Supreme Court would agree because it's not controversial that you can't say whatever you want at any time for any purpose whatsoever without regard to the consequences. That's always been the law. And so in many ways, this statute rests, frankly, on the surest of constitutional footing. The legislature wanted to make sure that CUPPA protected everybody, including pregnant women and including pregnant women that are considering what to do in the event of an unwanted or unexpected pregnancy. And we wanted to make sure that they had the full protection of law to make that decision without the interference of other people who don't have the right to interfere and without fraud or deception. And I supported that statute and it passed and I'm going to enforce the law.
The ADF has won 13 victories at the Supreme Court since 2011. As we fast forward to right now, how much of this do you think is a part or a reaction to the Senate Bill 8, the Texas abortion law?
So I can't speak about the specific case, but I will speak about Senate Bill 8. Let's just be clear. I was born in 1973, the year Roe v. Wade was handed down by the Supreme Court. So I and women of my generation, I'm 48 years old now, have only lived in a country and in a world in which reproductive health care and freedom was a woman's choice. And abortion is safe and legal. We continue to hope here in this country. What Texas has done is an offense to the Constitution, allowing people that might be our neighbors or someone down the street to turn themselves into vigilantes and to sue other people in their community, their neighbors, for exercising their constitutional right to consider their own healthcare options and potentially have an abortion.
Connecticut Attorney General William Tong, thank you for joining us on And Another Thing.
Thank you, Dara.
After the break, an expert on the First Amendment will help us better understand where the line is between free speech and, as this law claims, deceptive practices. Stay with us.
This is And Another Thing. I'm Maya Schwader.
And I'm Dara Kennedy. We continue our discussion on alleged deceptive marketing campaigns and the Connecticut Abortion Center entangled in a federal lawsuit with the state's attorney general's office, claiming the new law is infringing on the right to free speech. Really light stuff for your Wednesday evening drive here.
Schwader, we like to keep it easy breezy here at And Another Thing. The First Amendment has been invoked a lot this evening, opening up that age-old debate about whether, as the Attorney General mentioned earlier, it's okay to shout fire in a crowded theater. So for some clarity, we have an expert. Joining us now is Rob Birchie. He is a board member of the New England First Amendment Conference and a partner at Claris Law. Rob, thanks for being with us this evening. First question, maybe a big philosophical one, but what is the line between free speech and just being false?
Well, you just talked about the possibility of an easy breezy subject. You're right. The First Amendment is not easy breezy in any way. It purports to say Congress shall make no law abridging your freedom of speech. But in fact, Congress and government makes a lot of laws that abridge your freedom of speech. As the Attorney General pointed out, you can't shout fire in a crowded theater. Actually, you can if there is a fire. You just can't cry fire if there's no fire and you cause a panic that way. There are a lot of exceptions to to the First Amendment protections that are out there. And the Supreme Court has said pretty clearly that lies are not unprotected under the First Amendment. In other words, the First Amendment does protect false speech as well as true speech for a couple of reasons. One being that in many cases it's very hard to tell. But in another reason, as the ADF mentions in its complaint, if we know we're going to be punished if we go over that line between the truth and falsehood, and you're right, it's awfully hard to figure out where some things are in between.
Mm-hmm.
If we know that we're going to be punished if we go over the line, we're going to stay far clear of the line in
right.
order not to even risk being punished.
So you mentioned that there are some exceptions. Our guest earlier on the show mentioned that a lot of the advertising that these crisis pregnancy centers put out say things like pregnant, need help. Does that count as a lie in this case?
Well, you know, the government routinely prohibits unfair and deceptive speech in marketing. And as the Attorney General pointed out, every state has something of its own version of CUTPA, saying you cannot utter unfair and deceptive speech in the provision of a service or a product.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting to me, the ADF seems to admit that they are subject to that sort of marketing. And I think part of their argument is simply, if we are already subject to the general law that says in selling something and providing a service, you can't use unfair or deceptive speech, why does there need to be a separate law saying, particularly when you're talking about abortion services,
now,
you can't do unfair or deceptive speech?
The Massachusetts Supreme Court recently declined to enforce that state's Unfair and Deceptive Practices Act against a limited services pregnancy center. Do you think that this is going to set a precedent?
I thought it was an interesting strategic choice that the Pregnancy Counseling Center chose to say we do fall under the same regulations that say that govern your supermarket or your fruit seller, or whatever it may be. I would have thought that they might be arguing the importance of political speech, and that seems to be a secondary argument for them. In many ways, we have two regimes in this country. We say political speech is very, very protected, but unfair or deceptive speech in the advertising or commercial context has always been regulated, and nobody seems to question that.
Rob Birchie is a board member of the New England First Amendment Conference. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Abortion and health care are perpetual issues before voters nationally, and as we've seen today, locally as well. And next week is Massachusetts local elections. Western Massachusetts municipal leadership is about to look much different than it has in many years, as three mayors in the region hand over the reins to new leadership.
Yesterday, we heard from outgoing North Adams Mayor Tom Bernard. Today, former Holyoke Mayor Alex Morse. He is now the town manager in Provincetown, and he reflects on the future of his home city and his decision earlier this year not to run for re-election.
So my decision to not seek a fifth term as mayor of Holyoke was unrelated to my campaign for Congress last year against Congressman Neal. When I first ran for mayor in 2011, I said that I wanted to be mayor 8 to 10 years. I thought that was a long enough period of time to make a difference and leave a lasting legacy and really set a strong foundation for the next chief executive.
How hard was it for you to make that decision, not only to step down as mayor, but to ultimately leave Holyoke?
It was a really difficult decision. You know, I'm a Holyoker, born and raised in the city. And then, you know, a third of my life had been spent being mayor of the city. I was the fourth longest serving mayor. It was incredibly difficult to make the decision, but, you know, I felt like after 10 years, it was time to move on and Holyoke is home. It always will be. I was there over the weekend doing Western Massachusetts fall activities, seeing friends and family, and it's bittersweet in many ways. You know, last Friday I attended a ribbon cutting completion ceremony for Lyman Terrace, a project we started back in 2012. And that project that we started years ago are continuing to happen and to finish and to make a difference in the city.
How is life different for you now as town manager in Provincetown?
It's a different community. It's a different form of government. My 10 years in Holyoke has given me the skills and experience to excel here. You know, obviously we had a COVID uptick over the summer that we dealt with in, I think, a very effective way.
You have not been running a mayoral or a congressional campaign this year, so you weren't having to fundraise or go out and knock on doors. Do you miss that at all?
I certainly don't miss sitting in a room calling people for hours on end and asking them for money. That's one of the downsides of being in public office and why I support getting money out of politics.
Speaking of getting money out of politics, in your congressional campaign, you raised about $2.1 million. Congressman Neal raised nearly $5 million. How do you think progressives can hope to unseat powerful incumbents who receive more PAC money?
The fact that we were able to raise over $2 million and get over 40% of the vote was a really great feat against someone that has been in office for over three decades, chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. But, I mean, the fundamental rot is the fact that our congressmen and many other members of Congress, both Democrat and Republican, get the vast majority of their money from private corporations and corporate political action committees, and that skews the way in which they view policy. And so right now in this reconciliation package, you know, we see some Democrats fighting really hard to strengthen the bill, and we see other Democrats fighting to weaken the bill, oftentimes based on who they're getting their money from. You know, Western Mass is in many ways lagging behind when you look at general indicators around poverty and public health. And I think it's really important that any candidate in the future really focus on the outcomes and whether or not power and seniority have delivered the outcomes that the first district, I think, needs in many, many ways.
What are the biggest challenges your successor will face as Holyoke's first new mayor in a decade?
Housing is one of the big things we focused on. And, you know, we got us on a path to creating hundreds of new mixed income housing units throughout the community to address the housing shortage and affordable housing crisis in Western Mass and in Holyoke. I think it's important that the next mayor also continue capitalizing on the cannabis industry. We had more permits and licenses granted in Holyoke than any other community in the state, which is creating hundreds of jobs and millions of dollars in tax revenue and host agreement fees. And I think it's really important we continue marketing Holyoke as a place that continues to value manufacturing, but that's going to continue being a challenge. I think we have members of our city council and other elected bodies that were either Trump delegates or donating to Donald Trump and don't believe in democracy. And I think with the growth of misinformation on social media platforms and local forums, and I think it's important that the next mayor understand that they're entering in a climate where that is increasing both on the national level and on the local level.
Alex Morris is the former mayor of Holyoke. He's now the town manager in Provincetown. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your time.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
That's it for this edition of And Another Thing. I'm Maya Schwader.
And I'm Derek Kennedy. We hope you'll join us again.